Three, two, one.
We're keeping all that.
This in yeah, great, perfect.
I wrote down the number just in case.
In case you want to throw it as the cold open.
Yeah.
Welcome to Burritos and Other Less Important Things, or Ballot, or Balliquit, depending on who you talk to. My name is Nate. This is the third episode of the year 2021, the first official episode of, I guess, season three-ish of this podcast.
Sure.
Episode, who the fuck knows at this point? I'm here with Zach and Chris. How you guys doing?
Pretty good. I also have no idea how many podcasts we've recorded, what year this started, what you want to call this, is a season or a trimester like we had back in college. Who knows?
Why we're doing it? What's it?
No, it's to feel human connection out of the immense loneliness that has occurred during this pandemic. That is why we're
right,
doing
nailed
this.
It. Correct.
Yeah, I'm happy that we've moved on. This is our first of our new series where this is the new movie club. This is movie club version 2.0.
Yeah, so those of you who's psychotic enough to have followed along with us until this point, the previous format involved a lot of watching, you know, 20 to 30 movies in the span of a month or less, and so we've transitioned now into being less stupid and sticking with a sort of 3 to 4 movie format per pod, doing it more frequently. So you'll have to deal with us a lot more, but also a lot less. It's a good balance. So for today's episode, the focus of what we're going to be doing is the theme that's sort of tying it all together is ones we missed. The idea being movies that sort of slipped by us for one reason. And the criteria for that was a little different from person to person. So a good starting point might be to just kick it around and sort of talk about how you watch movies, how you sort of seek out movies, things like that, and what qualifies as something you missed or how something slips by you. So Zach, why don't you kick it off?
Sure. So I have gotten, since I moved to New York and like I said in the last podcast, got MoviePass and AMC A-List, that is when I really dove back into watching a bunch of movies, more so than just like a Star Wars movie that came out or one or two big blockbusters. Since I think, 2017 or 2018, whenever that happened, is when I really dove deep and was able to watch both like big blockbusters, giant comedies, but also like small little indie movies that are absolutely incredible. So my things I've missed focused more on older seminal classics, or even seminal classics from the 2000s and the 1990s, that while I was growing up, I would see the kind of standard fare, you know, what your parents would have on VHS or DVD. And I was, you know, pretty well versed in that kind of thing. But, you know, going back a little bit further or a little bit more indie or art house, I just completely missed for the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. So that's my biggest blind spot. Chris, what about you?
Yeah, I think the perfect category to start this new thing with, because it is so open to interpretation. What does missing a film really mean? And we have one from 2019, and of course, like, I think that's a great choice because I hadn't even heard of it until now. So literally completely missed it. My choice was from 2001, less of like, Pulp Fiction was very much like, you and your college buddies watch this movie and like talk about how awesome it is. And
nothing ages badly about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't watching Mulholland Drive with all of my college buddies.
No, but I was watching Requiem for a Dream, which we went over.
Yeah, it's almost just as bad.
It's way worse. Are you kidding
yeah,
me?
You're right. This. Yeah, so I didn't like. I wasn't 11 years old in 2001 like ready to watch Mulholland Drive,
crushing and, like, David Lynch movies.
Yeah. So I didn't miss it
with
in that
Dave
sense.
Gear on the couch. Be like, the fuck is going on here?
Yeah, it wasn't like I wish I had been more cognizant of this in 2001. It was just more like I've come to learn that I really like the particular style of weirdness that David Lynch goes for, and felt like I've seen it on a lot of end of decade lists from the 2000s, and a lot of people think of it as one of their favorite or at least one of the most interesting films that they've seen. And so yeah, I wanted to at least give it a shot.
Yeah, I sort of swung the other way. I'm definitely like compulsively a completionist, and so over the last couple of years especially, I think that's shifted to a certain extent in the direction of film, and I think because of that, a lot of my focus has been on modern movies that I can sort of keep up with as they're released, and playing catch up there, and paying really close attention to sort of what's a more high profile release that's, you know, I should be paying attention to, things like that. And so that's why, and we'll get into the movies, but that's why Atlantix jumped out for me, because it was a movie that I'd been hearing so much about and was sort of like an important gap to fill in the 2019 sort of canon, which I was already pretty well versed in, because I really, that year was a sort of big, one of the earlier years where I was really trying to go through and check all the boxes off. I had already seen Pulp Fiction. I hadn't seen Mulholland Drive, but I was familiar with, you know, some of Lynch's stuff. And then for our group pick, we picked Fruitvale Station, which was another one that's sort of like in the more modern sort of canon, but especially given Ryan Coogler's sort of ascendance as a director, was one that just felt like an important movie to fit in, even before you get to the actual content, like an important film in terms of the context of where film is now, where it's headed, the types of stories that are shown on screen, and understanding sort of the progression of cinema as it goes. Not to mention the sort of key characters, both Coogler behind the camera and Michael B. Jordan in front of it, as sort of like catching them at that moment in their ascendance. So the movies that we focused on were Atlantix, Mulholland Drive, Pulp Fiction, and Fruitvale Station. We're going to kind of knock through them in that order, and then we'll get to some of the usual categories, bring them back for those of you who've been listening to Ballot and sticking around to the end of episode. So for none of you, we'll be hitting the categories. And then we'll let you know about the next podcast that's coming up, which will be coming up in a couple weeks from now. And we're going to try and keep this pace for the year. So if you're interested in following along, we'll obviously announce the episodes on the pod, but you can also follow us on Letterboxd, on all the socials. We'll post our accounts and all that stuff. We usually sort of keep track of the lists and things like that. And again, it'll be sort of four movies an episode at this point for the
every two weeks or so.
Yeah. So, you know, a pace that a fairly sane, normal human could keep up with, hopefully.
Not somebody who averaged 4.6 movies per week last year.
Per day. Yeah. So, with that being said, let's dive in. Let's start off with Atlantix. This is a movie, again, came out in 2019. It was the directorial debut, feature-length directorial debut by Mati Diop. It's a Senegalese film. Pretty widely hailed in 2019, but then sort of fell to the wayside. It wasn't as high profile sort of as the year went on, as 2020 came on. And none of us had seen it prior to this. So, yeah, why don't we kick it around? Zach, what was your reaction watching this movie?
So this was actually one that I had on my to-watch list and just, for whatever reason, never got around to it. Our fan Gabe and patron saint of our Gabe fan club was one who highly suggested it or highly recommended it to me. And so I watched this last week and really genuinely loved it. I really knew nothing going into it, and I think that's a great way to approach it.
Yeah, good thing to mention. Like, if you haven't seen this movie, skip this part. This will be the one movie that we'll say, like, skip this discussion if you haven't seen it and watch it. Isn't it on Netflix?
It's on Netflix, and it's a great enter in blind, mm-hmm, type of situation.
Yeah.
All you really need to know is, it, you know, it takes place in Senegal. It's
It.
It's like that's the whole thing. Like,
so Zach, go ahead with what you were going to say. Spoilers from here on out.
Yes. So I watched the first, what, I don't know, 45 minutes, half an hour, or 45 minutes, hour of this movie, and was like, oh, this is a, like, really touching love story about, you know, a girl who's, you know, forced into a marriage she doesn't want to be in, to a richer man, married off into a loveless marriage, and has a love interest, Sulman, who she just can't be with, who is a poor person who has to jump on a boat to try and get to Spain to try and find work there as a refugee. And, you know, I thought it would be a you know, kind of normal-ish love story around that. And then it shifts. And, you know, spirits and ghosts and possessions are introduced. And there's this whole new layer. And I think one of the things I loved most about it is because it was a smaller budget, there was no effects that took me out of it. The way possession is shown is by just a, you know, glassy-eyed white pupil. You know, and that's the only effect there is. And I
And the use of mirrors.
Yes.
Yeah, there's some sneaky mirror tricks.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call that like a special effect. I think
No.
It's definitely an effect, but
yeah. But I think that was one of my favorite parts, is that it felt really grounded throughout the whole thing. So when these kind of supernatural parts were added into it, it felt seamless and so natural, and I was incredibly drawn in by that.
Yeah, the seamlessness is, that's the word for it, right? It's this like effortless transition between things that should be really jarring. And so it gives you like an unease, and like it's emotionally jarring without the actual sort of like cognitive dissonance that you'd normally get from it, which I thought was really effective. And I think just more broadly with that, like the, first of all, as a directorial debut, like having this much command over what you're doing and this much nuance with what you're doing, like there was so much care to making sure that the story was never trying to hit you over the head with anything. The reveal that her lover has died isn't even clear that it actually happened. It's sort of told off screen, and then you're not sure, and then it becomes clear, but you're still not entirely sure. And not in a way that's like careless, in this way that's very deliberately like the echoing the confusion that a person would have if they did not have contact with this person, and you're in this situation where you don't have a way to communicate with someone who's chosen to go across the ocean to try and find work.
Not even chosen. It's almost forced to go across the ocean.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, for sure. No, not in any way making this. Not to belittle that at all, for sure. But to that point, I think like when we talk about more representation of or giving more access to a diverse array of creators and actors and directors and to get those sort of stories on the screen, I think oftentimes that gets spun in a more tokenized way, in like like you're checking the box. But the reason for it isn't because you need to sort of check off a certain quota of people in those roles. The reason is because you get people telling these stories where, like, this is a story that contends with like issues of refugee crisis, issues of like migrant work, issues of like the laborers being taken advantage of in these ways that are seamlessly woven into the narrative, where it's part of a story. The story is not a message piece trying to tell you, like, here's the point of this. Let me, like, give you this thesis statement. It's a really brilliant, really sort of grounded narrative that carries all those things because the director is speaking from personal experience grounded in this place and is telling the story of that place. And if you have a director, if you only have, like, white male directors telling every story, you don't get that nuance.
Yeah, why didn't Michael Bay direct this?
Yeah, it is weird, right? I mean, I feel like the ghost effects could have been a lot stronger. So that, I mean, that was the thing that kept coming back to me as I was sort of sitting with this movie. It was just like how much it did with how little, and how important it is and how effective it is. Just like have a young director come in and tell the story that they've clearly been wanting to in such a nuanced and such a careful way. That just makes for one of the most compelling films.
Yeah, I think for me, I agree with everything you guys just said. It's such an interesting film, and it's also just a really enjoyable watch because it combines so many elements from so many different genres of film that I enjoy and that I know we as a podcast enjoy. You've got crime drama, you have the like spirits of dead sailors, and then of course you've got the labor disputes that we know and love from several films and documentaries that we've watched.
Mainly the Star Wars like, prequels
and The Replacements.
Yeah.
Star Wars prequels, The Replacements, in Atlantix. Is that one of our episodes coming up soon?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
add in, add in whatever that Kentucky coal miners documentary
Harlan
was.
Harlan County, USA.
Jesus Christ.
We got ourselves an episode. We could do like a best of supercut of Ballad.
For our final episode.
But yeah, I agree. It's just such a subtle film where I mean the whole idea of our main character not knowing whether he's alive or dead, and then kind of like having all of these people around her telling her that he's alive is kind of what you were alluding to, Nate, with like the film kind of leaving you uncertain with what's going on. I don't really have a whole lot else to add. I did watch the so there's a Mati Diop short film on the Criterion Network, in the Criterion Collection. It's like 15 minutes long, by the same name, 10 years earlier. And it's really just like it's the story of the migrant workers trying to make the decision to go to Spain. And that kind of gives some background into like, that part of the film isn't really dealt with in Atlantix, where like you get the result of that decision, but you don't really get the background. Like you see what instigates the decision, like this big labor dispute, this construction company withholding 3 months of pay for all of its workers building this huge building, and you don't really see the in between there, where it's like, okay, a bunch of people coming together and being like, oh, all right, like here's what's available abroad that we could potentially do, and that it's just like a little intimate film of them just making this decision. It doesn't have any like consequences at the time, but it's a really interesting kind of background where like definitely didn't need to be in the film, but it was cool just to watch that and see kind of just a little extra.
One of my favorite small decisions that this movie makes is there is a club that's kind of a central location. It's revisited a couple times. The club is never shown when it's actually at full capacity and people are enjoying themselves there. It is only used as this setting for depression and loss. And when that comes full circle at the end, it's really incredible. But the idea of keeping, you know that this club should be fun the entire time. There are the lights, the green lights flashing over all of the characters while they're on their phones, learning that, you know, all of their boyfriends or husbands or brothers or have abandoned them, and or not abandoned them, you know what I mean. But it's just a great direction to just show this place that's usually associated with happiness and joy and dancing and drinking and celebrating with just pure isolation almost. And I really love that touch.
Yeah. There's the use of like, again, just narratively speaking, like the use of signifiers like that of like, you know, what the club starts to represent, what that sort of like looming futuristic tower kind of represents without ever needing to be sort of forced on you, without ever needing to be sort of hammered over the head. Those images that get established pretty early on carry so much weight throughout the movie. The same with the mirror shots. It's sort of like a reflection of the internal life of people and sort of the way that you're seeing the mirror of like what's on the outside versus what's internal. And it's a command from a director however we define that, like a new to feature films director that really was astonishing, and I'm very excited to see what Mati Diop does next, because this is a pretty unbelievable first foray.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some really good performances in the film, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't recall the detective's name, but that performance is really good. That's another thing I wanted to mention, like the unease that you feel of the film. Like you, like Zach was saying earlier, like it kind of catches you off guard with the whole spirit thing. Like I had no idea that was coming, but there's this unease of like there's this detective checking these things out, and he keeps having these weird like heat strokes or whatever, where he's just kind of like fainting spells, and he gets all sweaty. And the doctors keep saying he's totally fine. So you know something weird is going on, but you don't know that it's kind of a universal thing. It seems like it's just with him. But, yeah, it's just those little choices that were made during the film. It's just excellent.
Yeah, highly recommend.
Highly recommend. Although you won't hear that because you're skipping ahead. So we'll at some point in the midst of our next conversation say we highly recommend this movie.
It'll be the cold open.
Yeah, right.
No, that's you yelling at Lexi being like, hey, you want your stupid dog? Anyway.
All right.
So, Chris, the next movie was yours. So you want to kind of give us a little intro?
Yeah, 2001. Mulholland Drive, directed by David Lynch, starring Naomi Watts, principally. There are other people in it, like Justin Theroux, and but it's really a Naomi Watts spotlight. Hard to say what this movie's about without getting too in the weeds, but I guess it's when you start the film, you are placed in a world where a woman has just gotten into a car accident, and she wanders her way from Mulholland Drive where the accident was. What's up, Zach?
So I think one of the big things you missed is she got into an accident after being almost assassinated.
Yeah, so she's sitting in the back of a car, and the driver and the person in the passenger seat turn around with guns, and then a bunch of crazy kids come speeding around the corner, and
like they do.
Yeah, you know. And then Rita, I guess, is her name in the first whatever two-thirds of the movie. So she wanders down into the valley and finds a place to stay. And then we cut to Naomi Watts arriving in L.A. With some crazy old people who are
genuinely the unequivocally the scariest part of that entire movie is the cut to those old people smiling in the car. I don't think I've been as disconcerted watching anything. Zach, I don't appreciate you doing that now. You need to stop.
Her patting him on the knee, yeah. And they're like just smiling way too widely. That's kind of where you know, if you weren't already like, okay, we got assassins, we got a weird car accident, if you weren't already put off by that, this is for sure the scene that lets you know that you're in for a wild ride. Because
I hear this David Lynch fellow makes nuanced, quiet films in the style of Matty Diop.
So, yeah, so you're put in this world where Naomi Watts arrives in L.A. Everything is super bright and
dreamlike. Very,
yeah, it's dreamlike. And it's like very classic, like woman arrives in LA with bright eyes and with the world ahead of her, and she just wants to become a movie star and everything good is going to happen to her. And then you get this interesting story of she goes back to her aunt's house and discovers Rita there, who has amnesia from the car accident, and it's them kind of trying to discover who Rita is and what was up, because Rita definitely knows that there was something wrong, doesn't quite remember that she was trying to be assassinated, but definitely has this feeling like something bad was going to happen to her.
Rita also names herself Rita after a Rita Hayworth poster. Like she doesn't know her own name.
Yes.
She takes that on, and then so part of it is actually like trying to seek out who she is, and yeah.
And then you kind of discover later on that this was all a dream of...
It was all a dream!
...of Naomi Watts. And it's really this kind of guilty fever dream that she has after putting out a hit on the woman she loves, Carmella?
Camilla.
Yeah. And kind of all of the manifestations of different people she knows and feelings of different interpersonal relationships in that dream. And it's a really backwards movie that is rewarded heavily from a rewatch.
Oh yeah.
Where a lot of the things that maybe 100% flew over my head, at least in the first watch, become these brilliant choices when you watch it again.
So
I do want to caveat that while I think that that is a fantastic summation of it, there are a lot of theories about this movie because it is very much so a movie that doesn't tie a bow around it. Mm-hmm. And so the determination of whether or not the whole thing is a dream, the first part is a dream, some iteration, like there's variations in terms of how it's interpreted. But I agree with you. I think that's the breakdown.
So I'm really interested to see where you guys kind of clued in that something was wrong here in this movie. So there's obviously the scene at Winky's that we will touch on a little bit later, where it is two non-main characters in the movie that share the whole screen. It is not attached to anything, and then it moves on. But I think it was really her audition that really cemented the fact that, like, okay, something's weird. Actually, so I don't remember the exact order. It was either Billy Ray Cyrus showing up or the audition.
That was an incredible moment.
Yeah. I knew that Chris had watched this and Nate, you hadn't. So I was texting him on this. I was like, Billy Ray fucking Cyrus is in this movie? Like, what is happening?
I believe I turned to Lexi and, like, in her face screamed, is that Billy Ray Cyrus?
And it just kind of slowly chips down at you to realize that this isn't right. That something is wrong in this first, I think it's almost like 2/3 or 3/4 of the movie.
It's about, whereas
first section. And then once the script flips and it's on the other side, my brain had a really hard time accepting that this was the actuality of it. You know, I was like, oh, maybe now they're in some weird fever dream. And it took me a while to, like, really genuinely realize what was happening. I don't know if you guys felt the same way.
I think I had a... So, I'm not sure. I know, Chris, you've watched Twin Peaks. Zach, have you seen Twin Peaks before?
I was absolutely going to say Twin Peaks as well.
Right. So, part of the thing with this is, if you have watched Twin Peaks, there's a tolerance for, like, Lynchian insanity that you kind of build up. You're simultaneously, I think, even more hyper aware of the things that are a little off and the things that are a little weird, and also more tolerant of those things existing in a quote unquote real scenario. Mm-hmm. You know, Twin Peaks obviously, like, plays with dream and reality and stuff like that, but it's also, there's just a level of surrealism incorporated into the quote unquote real world within the Twin Peaks world. Twin Peaks, for those of you who don't know, a Lynch TV show that's an all-time classic.
For some reason, was allowed on ABC at, like,
prime time. I have no idea who was snorting what to let that happen. But so you have that end of it, and then you also have the opposite end, which is like a sequence like the board meeting for that with the director, which is like probably the first, aside from maybe the grandparents and I'm you know, a little lost on the order, because it all, you know, it's so non-linear in a lot of ways, but that's one of the first, like, most glaring, nope, that's not the way real shit works
when he just spits out the espresso and then they yell
when he spits out the espresso and that whole thing and the way that they interact, and at the same time is something that is very akin to so many sequences in Twin Peaks. So I wasn't sure for a lot of this movie whether it was Lynch being Lynch or whether it was not real. Yeah. And that's a really effective thing that I think would be a different experience if this was your first or an earlier intro to Lynch, or you hadn't spent as many hours sort of living in a Lynchian world. There's a different conversation to be had about the connection to Twin Peaks that has a little to do with my reaction with this movie, but we can save that. So, yeah.
Yeah, my experience was similar because probably not a good movie to watch after you've been drinking for a while and then at like 9 p.m. or like, hey, let's watch this movie. So that combined with my previous experience having watched Twin Peaks, that level of acceptance, yeah, that's a perfect way of putting it, because that's to have seen the entire way through the film and have enjoyed it in a way, but not really understand maybe some of the theory behind it. And so having that time to, one, have some really weird dreams, and two, read some things and get some theories, and then be able to go revisit it and look at it through the lens of somebody who definitely has a little more expectation going into it of what I'm going to be seeing and what I'm looking for. Very rewarding, and also I think points to one of those kinds of films where it only improves on rewatch, where like I think this is, so I don't know if you did the same thing, Zach, but I rated it at 4.5 stars the first time I watched it, because I knew there were some things I really loved about it, as far as the direction goes, as far as the acting in that first mm-hmm. part of the film, where everyone's just like kind of hamming it up and being a little weird, kind of very soap opera-y like Twin Peaks is, which if you haven't seen Twin Peaks, it's basically like a parody of a soap opera in some ways. And so like I was prepared for that kind of level of stuff. But getting all these meta commentaries on Hollywood and how Hollywood treats its women, it was all very interesting to me. And then you kind of get that zap into what at the time I wasn't really sure about what it was, but having the Twin Peaks background, I'm used to people just teleporting from one place to another. But suddenly like the acting being a lot better, like Naomi Watts just goes ham on the last yep. whatever 45 minutes.
That was one of the most jarring in the best way experiences with this film, was like, you know, watching and knowing she's doing a bit the whole time, but still being kind of like, all right, you know, all right, no, like, cool. And then when it flips, and there's the shot in particular is the one where she's, it's one of the very sort of sudden time jumps as it's doing the sort of jumping around, when she's in the kitchen and she's looking, she's making the coffee and she looks over and she goes, "Camilla, you're back." And it's just on her yep. face as she's kind of like decomposing. And it was one of the most jarring, like, because the movie has prepared you to see her in this one way, and all of a sudden you're seeing her simultaneously like playing the, because it's not the same as the full-on flip that you saw before where it's just she's playing a different character.
Yeah,
it's like a version that's kind of like reaching back to who she was in the like the idealized version, but can't get there and is breaking down. It was just like one of the most incredible acting performances in the shortest period of time. Really astonishing.
But also
like,
now that really, you bring that really up, having her do so many different pieces of acting within the movie is so interesting too. Having one, like her just being like a bad actress in the very beginning, but then yeah. reading that scene with Rita and you see like, oh, like, as an actress in the movie, she's good. And then you see her do the scene in front of all of the executives, and it's like, well, okay, she went for it, but like, yeah. that's what they wanted to see. So you see her kind of play right. the game. And then you actually get to see Naomi Watts act later. And that's such a good construction of that. And it's not something I really thought of until right now.
I don't know, this movie, I have thought about this movie more than just about any other that I've ever watched in my entire life. Yeah. It is one that I immediately wanted to go back and rewind scenes and watch and kind of see what I missed. Like, I could put some connections in of, like, the Blue Key and having those as parallels and the name Diane and how that is and fake Diane going, Betty, it's weird. It's Betty. Weird calling yourself, isn't it? You know, those kind of clues that are, you know, very obviously left for all of us. But you don't really...
Her saying it's like being in a dream world or something like that about LA.
Literally, right. Yeah. This dream, I'm in this dream place. Yeah.
And fucking Billy Ray Cyrus being in this movie.
Well, the Justin Theroux transition from being like this, the cuck, basically. Like, he's just this
bumbling
ne'er-do-well who's having his whole, his film taken from him by a bunch of mobsters. And then come back around to
he's a Casanova,
quote unquote, real world, and he's dating the big actress, and it's fascinating. Yeah. There's so much to talk about, and I'm sure
we won't pool. Get to
like 10% of
she
it.
She got the pool boy.
Well, and that I think the understanding the construction, because again, despite the fact that there are many theories, like I fully ascribe to the like. First part is a dream. Second part is a non-linear version of real life.
And well, and there are some dreamlike qualities that could be attributed to drug use and other things.
Right, exactly.
I mean, Cafe Silencio, even of itself.
Oh, what a great scene!
Unbelievable. That idea of like her in the process of some sort of breakdown, whether it's drug induced, whether it's a mental illness thing, whatever, whatever's happening to her, her sort of reliving those moments. When you understand that framing, the experience of each of those characters, like there's such a command of the subconscious and how the subconscious works, of how she's solving every problem that she has in the dream and in the construction of the dream. Like the dude who was the witness, who like saw the actual crime happen, just gets scared to death. Yeah. Like, solved. We did it. It's good. We solved it. And Justin Theroux, who's like the guy who's with her ex, is a cuck and it has a terrible life and it's not working out. The assassin
is a bumbling idiot, which is one of the funniest scenes. Who doesn't pull it off?
That scene was so fun, and that is maybe the most that and the boardroom scene are the two scenes that were the most Twin Peaks for me. Where I was like, oh, it's just Twin Peaks. Okay, cool. I understand.
Twin Peaks: The Return basically redoes that scene at a certain point.
Really, I still need to watch that. That's the one thing that I will say is. For both of you, it was the 4.5 to 5, and for me, it was the 4 to 4.5 on the rewatch, where I think, as someone who loved Twin Peaks, coming into this movie, and maybe it's a product of having seen Twin Peaks more recently in conjunction with this, you know, I watched that for the first time a couple of years ago, so it's a little bit fresher. There was a little bit of rehashing it that it wasn't that I don't like those stylistic flourishes, it just felt a little bit less like... I was less surprised. It was less thrown off, and it felt a little bit like, okay, this is Lynch's.
What's your
thing,
problem with red curtains, Nate?
Yeah, right. It's the red curtains thing. If I see one more fucking red curtain, every red curtain, I just demote by half a star. And so that was a totally a personal aesthetic thing of just being like, yeah, all right, that demoted it by half a star. So it's a 4.5 for me instead of a 5.
How dare
but
you?
But I know I'm a real fucking bastard. But it just. I mean, really, as like a narrative construction for a movie, you know, the it was all a dream thing is a cliche. And to be able to pull off the it was all a dream thing in a way that makes the dream feel very real and lived in and compelling and also exactly like a dream would be.
Yeah,
it is.
And then to pull off.
It is like, the only movie that has made me feel like the it's a dream thing is a reward and not a punishment as a reveal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's a great way to frame it.
To your point, Nate, just the command of the subconscious there. The feeling I had rewatching the movie is it legitimately feels like, have you ever been in a dream and even though you've never had that dream before, you feel like you've had that dream before?
Yes.
That's what watching this movie feels like.
Yeah.
It's
that's a great observation.
I would highly recommend anyone watch this movie and try your best not to second screen it all until it's done. You know, this this is one where, you know, even if you miss something and it's not like incredibly helpful to the plot, it whatever is missing adds so much to the feeling of the movie and the mental state that you're supposed to be in.
Yeah.
So, for an example, our designated Hitler this week has like basically no relevance to the plot because it comes in at 12 minutes into the movie and is just a vibe check, you know?
Yeah,
that's like, exactly.
It is just like, I'm going to make you incredibly uncomfortable and anxious. And that's and what this scene is going to do.
And then maybe scare you a little.
Yeah.
And legit one of the biggest jump scares of the entire Bowlet Movie Club to this point. Like, absolutely startling shit.
Better or worse than the, hey, does... In How I Live Now, does anyone get shot in the head? Oh, no, definitely not.
Or the Scooby-Doo in...
right?
Oh, yeah.
127 Hours. So I knew the jump scare was coming because it is frequently listed as the scariest jump scare in a not scary movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see
and
that.
And it is.
Really startled by it, and it's not even that it has a strong music cue, but it lasts like 0.02 seconds.
Oh, it goes silent,
and then it goes silent. Yeah. And it freaks you the fuck out.
Yep,
man.
And that's one of the. There's a lot of, again, for being a very opaque and like convoluted in an effective way, but like convoluted story. It is decipherable and you can figure out the thread through it. That's the one part, not the scare and what that signifies, but that character, that's responsible for the jump scare, is one of the few lingering things that's like, you gotta unpack what you think that is. Cause it doesn't, you know, it's not right there for you in the way that some of the other things are if you rewatch, which is interesting. Cause that character returns in the later.
Yeah,
in the non-dream iteration, but it's clearly not grounded in reality. But
maybe
the tiny little people walking out of the paper bag clue you on that.
Jesus,
it's that. It's also the cowboy, which we haven't even touched on.
The cowboy is such a great character. That scene where one of my favorite lines is when he just says, did you agree just to agree with me, or did you actually think about it and agree with what I said, to paraphrase? Yeah. And that whole back and forth is incredible.
You're going to be a
very
smart
closely
Alec?
Right after that is one of my favorite lines in the movie, which is the, like, if you're, I don't remember the exact, it's something like, if you're good, I'll see you once. You'll see me once. If you're bad, you'll see me twice.
Yeah.
And which is in a conversation with Justin Theroux's character, and is totally, you know, is within that dream context. And then you see him once more, I believe in the dream context. And then you very quickly see him the second time in the sequence right before she decides to call the hit.
Yeah. Yep.
And that shit was like, the second that happens, you're like, oh, okay.
That's bad.
Oh, no.
One thing we should mention that's not... plot related, Angelo Badalamenti did the score for this film. He did the score for Twin Peaks as well. Just incredible stuff. Like,
also, according to Wikipedia, composed the 1992 Summer Olympics in Barcelona theme.
Nice. Huh. He also plays one of the brothers of that like team trying to get the dream Camilla to be in the movie.
Man, trying to explain this movie in like separate parts is just fucking impossible.
Tying yourself in knots.
It's Melissa George's
so
first
good,
Camilla Rhodes. It's like, what?
Yeah. Zach, to your point, like I lumped this in. I think that this is, you know, probably a better movie, but I lumped this in with what's the movie that we watched? Oh, yikes. Okay.
Inception.
Rango.
No, we're gonna roll it back.
Name random ballot movies.
Dark Tower, obviously.
Yeah.
Shit. I lost it.
Explain the movie.
I got it. Okay, we're going back in. 3, 2, 1.
We're keeping all that.
This in yeah, great, perfect.
I wrote down the number just in case.
In case you want to throw it as the cold open.
Yeah.
It's reminiscent in certain ways in terms of the, like, you can't stop thinking about it, whether you're watching it or not, in that the I'm thinking of ending things mm-hmm. way yeah. of, like, it's a movie that the construction is inherently fucking with you. And not fucking with you just to fuck with you. Like, fucking with you is a very deliberate narrative device that is helping to tell the story. And the way that it keeps unfolding as you just kind of sit with it mm-hmm. or, like, go to sleep and wake up and you're thinking about a new thing, which is a whole other thing to unpack because you're literally living the process of the movie. Fuck you, David Lynch. Like, it's really brilliant. It's a really brilliant construction, and it's a really brilliant manifestation of a really interesting concept in a way that doesn't feel cheap and doesn't feel like you're just leaning on the concept as a way to pull something off. I mean, this is going to end up being a 5-star for me at some point.
Yes.
I already know that. I've just resigned myself to that.
I mean, for me, the thing that denotes 5-star movie in my head is all-time classic. And after watching it the second time, I was like, yeah, I feel pretty comfortable saying this is an all-time classic.
100% agree.
For me, the thing that denotes 5-star movie is Justin Theroux. So I feel like I should already.
Well, I mean, for me, it's Billy Ray Cyrus. So.
Punching Cyrus. Justin Theroux.
Yeah. Do you want to get to our designated Hitler of the round?
Yeah, we might as well.
Yeah, why not?
Knock it out right now. While it's fresh in the mind.
So, Nate, I think you're going to be hosting this one more or less as the stage directions.
Yeah, I will be holding point on the stage direction. So just again, a reminder for all you listener. Our designated Hitler is the, you know, the category that we usually give to either the most problematic thing that comes up or just a really fucking weird thing in the movies,
like,
that we watch.
I think
it could be a speech, it could be a quote. It's, you know, usually something that's somewhere in between being, like, interesting and weird, or, like, kind of problematic but not so much that it's really fucked up for us to say it.
Yeah.
Because don't worry, there's other contenders that are coming up later
for sure.
So for this time we went with the designated Hitler of the Winkies scene. So this is the Winkies scene. Here we go. Two well-dressed men, Herb and Dan, mid-30s, are sitting at a table drinking coffee. Herb has finished eating his breakfast, but Dan hasn't touched his bacon and eggs. He appears too nervous to eat. A blonde waitress with a nameplate saying Diane lays the check on the table and smiles, then walks off.
Why'd you want to go to breakfast if you're not hungry?
I just wanted to come here.
To Winkies? I wasn't going to say anything, but why Winkies?
This Winkies.
Okay, why this Winkies?
It's kind of embarrassing, but...
Go ahead.
I had a dream about this place.
Oh, boy.
You see what I mean?
Okay, so you had a dream about this place.
Well,
tell me.
It's the second one I've had, but they were both the same. They start out that I'm in here, but it's not day or night. It's kind of half night. But it looks just like this, except for the light. But I'm scared, like I can't tell you. Of all people, you're standing right over there by that counter. You're in both dreams and you're scared. I get even more frightened when I see how afraid you are, and then I realize what it is. There's a man in the back of this place. He's the one. He's the one that's doing it. I can see him through the wall. I can see his face, and I hope I never see that face ever outside a dream.
There's more stage directions. I just need to pause. I didn't remember I never see that face outside of a dream, and then you see the face outside the dream at the end. Fuck you, David Lynch. Herb stares at Dan. Herb stares at Dan to see if he will continue. Dan looks around nervously, then stares at his uneaten food.
That's it.
So you came to see if it's out there?
To get rid of this god-awful feeling.
Right then.
Herb gets up, picks up the bill, and then goes to the cashier to pay. Dan just sits. As Herb is paying the bill, he looks over at Dan just as Dan is turning to look at him. From Dan's point of view, Herb is standing exactly in the same spot he stood in the dream. Spoiler alert, comes back, because it's exactly where Dan stands in real life when he's witnessing the hit, the getting called. Herb gets a strange feeling, turns back, and finishes up with the cashier. He motions for Dan to follow him. Dan rises reluctantly, and he and Herb make their way outside. Cut to exterior Winkies. Now Herb waits for Dan to lead the way.
Around here.
Dan takes Herb across the front of the Winkies to a narrow sidewalk that leads down the side towards the back. They begin walking down the narrow sidewalk past a payphone. Dan begins to sweat the nearer they get to the rear corner of the building. Red bricks glide slowly by. Closer on Dan. Beads of sweat cover his face. He finds it difficult to breathe. Herb is standing behind him, unable to see the fear overtaking his friend, but Herb can feel something himself. The red bricks moving closer now are coming to an end. The corner is coming closer. The corner is now very close. Suddenly, a man, a face, a dark face, a face dark and bum-like, moves quickly. Face dark and bum-like is hilarious. That is the funniest fucking stage reaction. Moves quickly out from behind the corner and stops, freezes, staring into Dan's eyes. Dan lurches back. All his breath is suddenly gone. He falls back into Herb, who tries to catch him as he's falling. Dan hits the ground, unable to breathe, his eyes wide with horror. Herb looks up. The man is gone. He looks down at Dan.
Dan! Dan, are you alright? Dan!
He kneels down and studies his friend. He feels for a pulse in the neck. He listens for breathing. His friend is dead.
My God!
Incredible stuff.
And scene.
Well done.
Bum like. Holy shit.
Yeah, you got a bum like face, dude.
It's brutal. Brutal burn. I mean, aside from the incredible stage directions, I like the fact that he writes text exactly how
it came out.
That's how you talk in a dream. What the fuck?
Yeah. Oh God. It's so good. 5-star Nate? Are you there yet?
Yeah, I'm fucking moving up. Jesus Christ. Live action me boosting my Letterboxd
rating. I only God make them 5 stars if I can act in them.
It's the closest I'll ever get to the screen. All right. Switching gears. We ready to move on?
Well,
I think we...
right before we move on, there is a behind the scenes on YouTube. If you watch this movie and want to go do, there's like a 25 minute. It's not like a documentary style. It's literally just someone holding a camera, and you get to watch David Lynch direct this, and it's pretty cool. They do the diner scene from the second half with Naomi Watts doing the hit or like buying the hit, I guess, and then they do the scene of them walking up the secret path to the dinner, and then they do the scene at the dinner where Naomi Watts reacts to the news that Camilla and Justin Theroux are getting married. And it's pretty incredible.
Another great moment of like never actually say,
dude, that is some non-vocal acting that is incredible.
They do it so well, and they never. And this, there's a number of these things, right? It's the same thing with that. It's the same thing with that. The Winky scene of like the shit that you just 100% know that they never actually say. They never say they're getting married,
except in the other 5 takes.
Okay, yeah, all right, fair enough.
And they use the one without it.
Yeah, but it's really interesting how they play with that stuff. If there's just like a real command of an understanding of like what you're going to get and how much they need to give you in order to get you there without needing to give you more than that. And you know, a director and a movie taking its audience, giving its audience enough credit to figure that out. Or I guess you could spin that as saying fuck you to any part of the audience that doesn't get it is, obviously like a challenging thing, but I think a really rewarding thing, especially for multiple watches.
Yeah, and if you want to see Naomi Watts flex, obviously what she does in the film is great. The behind the scenes, seeing her go from just I'm an actor right now, and then like turn it on, is pretty incredible.
Yeah, shouts to Naomi Watts. She's very good.
She might show up in our 2001 Lotties.
Oh God, we got to do that.
Yep. All right, shifting gears. We're gonna pivot over to Pulp Fiction.
I gotta pee.
All right.
We're gonna pivot over to Zach P.
And getting another beer.
I might do
and
that too.
Getting another beer. Deep in stage directions, shit. All right. Pivoting from Mulholland Drive, we're going to swing it over to the only movie that some of us had seen for this pod, but Zach was insistent on having
Is Pulp that how Fiction. It
went? It's 100% how it went. Pulp Fiction, the Quentin Tarantino, some might say masterpiece, sure. The film by Quentin Tarantino.
I don't think you need to down talk Pulp Fiction. I mean, it's one of the most
it's a very celebrated film by Quentin Tarantino. So Zach, why don't you kick it off as the person who's experiencing Pulp Fiction for the first time?
Sure. It is weird to watch Pulp Fiction for the first time in 2020 when you are a person who watches a bunch of other movies and talks to people who watch a bunch of other movies and hang around with people who may accidentally quote Pulp Fiction from time to time, or have heard quotes from it, or have seen scenes from it. So I had probably seen 5 to 10% of this movie just through that, which is a really weird way to watch a movie, because it would be like something I've seen 5 minutes of screen time, a quote I've heard 5 minutes of screen time. And it was just kind of peppered with these like memories that I already had about something that I already, that I had never watched. So that was a really bizarre way to watch a film.
Turns out that's how the movie's constructed.
Yeah, right. It is. But I really loved it. It is not a shocker to say that Pulp Fiction is a good movie, and the non-linear style of storytelling is incredibly done here.
Mm-hmm.
And that listening to John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson just talk to each other for a while is like super interesting and fascinating. And that Uma Thurman fucking kills it in this role. It is like none of these are shocking things. I don't think I'm treading any new ground by saying Pulp Fiction is a good movie, as Bowlett often does. Bowlett, we tread no new ground.
The road most traveled.
But I don't know. Even for a movie that was heralded so highly, I was like completely enthralled by it the whole time. I mean, obviously I had known of scenes like Vincent actually shooting the guy in the back of the car, you know, that, so that wasn't a surprise for me, which was kind of a bummer as far as one of the shocking scenes, just, you know, I already knew about just because it's in, you know, American movie lexicon.
I don't think it makes the movie better to be surprised by that personally, but that's my own preferences in terms of movie watching and minimizing the exploding head surprises.
No, I mean, I think it's
well documented.
Shouts to How I Live Now.
The only connection that How I Live Now and Pulp Fiction. No, I mean,
jarring tonal shifts.
That's fair. I don't know. You know, the scene of like John Travolta and Uma Thurman dancing is just there for no reason, but is really incredible.
That's not no reason. If you have John Travolta in a movie, you better make him dance, or you're contractually mandated.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I mean, I was really impressed by it, and having seen, I think I've seen like 7 or 8 other Tarantino films, just hadn't seen this one yet.
Yeah.
It's very much of his style, and I really loved it. I don't know. Nothing crazy to say.
So I've long been in the Pulp Fiction is overrated camp, but like it's at once overrated and still a really good, both influential and influenced film. You get a lot of really, I mean, the nonlinear storytelling in this movie is some of the best nonlinear storytelling that's ever been done. Like you said, Zach, the conversations that characters have, just like living in these small moments, and like you kind of get to know these characters really well in a lot of things that wouldn't, that don't seem consequential to the plot. And I think the plot is kind of,
who cares?
Yeah, it's not
the point. You didn't, I don't even think explain the plot of this movie point.
When you're summarizing it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
No one cares.
I think the thing that that I always come back to is the Bruce Willis stuff doesn't really work for me. I love him as an actor in this movie. I think he does a really good job. I just don't think that stuff is necessary to the plot, and I think it acts mostly just to break up the linear storytelling. And I think that's been my biggest problem in the past, having this might be the movie that I've started watching and not finished the most times, like in one watch, because it's pretty long and it can get a little bit exhausting if you're like, you get past your favorite scenes, like all of the Samuel L. Jackson, I think, to me, was the thing that stood out most in this.
By far, he's unbelievable in this.
Yeah, in this.
It's truly not close. Yeah, it's a real, like, him and Uma Thurman race, and then a fucking vast chasm.
Yeah, it's...
And then Christopher Walken.
Yeah, Christopher Walken, Harvey Keitel are chilling... And Ving Rhames. I think that's a trio. Yeah. And then you have another fucking giant gap.
Yeah, I mean, so we can get into the criticisms that I more obviously had this time around, because I hadn't seen this movie in a long time. This is probably the fourth time I've seen it, and it's been maybe 10 years since the last time I saw it. Just more recently having this exposure to movies like The Hateful Eight, where it's become way more apparent to me that a white man wrote this movie. And obviously there are like contextual things with movies like The Hateful Eight and Django, where like, okay, it's understandable that characters would be using racial epithets. This movie, it's very jarring that like every minor character in a situation is using the N-word. Like the drug dealer is doing it. Quentin Tarantino himself as a minor character, which is a whole other thing we'll probably get into, but the scenes with the like weird music shop owner and the security guard, where like I think you could write those characters totally fine without making them overt racists. Christopher Walken's character, I think, kind of falls more under the like contextual category, where I think maybe a war veteran would be talking like that. But then the one that was really jarring for me was Tim Roth. Like there's
Tim Roth, just
zero
reason
for that.
Spewing that shit. Yeah.
And like I can try to cope with it in my mind, like what Tarantino's thinking, like everybody's racist, so of course they're going to talk like this. And like I understand that, like, yeah, that's a thing, but like it doesn't seem like it's relevant to the plot of the movie to make all of your minor characters do that.
Yeah, there's a... This was one of the first... maybe the first or second Tarantino movie that I saw. I think it was probably the first. I think I probably saw this and then Inglourious Basterds. And then Kill Bill afterwards. So it was, you know, my like stylistic introduction to him, and I think my initial reactions to this movie were very sort of based on the stylistic components of it, and agreed that the nonlinear storytelling is brilliant, and the construction of it is brilliant, and also agreed, I think the pacing is a little wonky, and you could do the same nonlinear storytelling and interesting things cutting out a whole plot line out of this movie and be fine. But it's really impactful. I think at this point I have it probably as like my sixth favorite Tarantino, somewhere in there. The defense that I've heard used a lot about a lot of his movies, the ones that aren't situated in circumstances like The Hateful Eight and Django, which I think are a different conversation, though still a very valuable conversation in terms of like use of the N-word and use of racial epithets and things like that. But movies that are situated in modern times where racism and racial epithets are sort of like core features of the characters, that the defense that comes up a lot is that he talks about how he and some of his defenders talk a lot about how all of his characters are somewhere along the sort of flawed to evil spectrum, and that that is a manifestation of that, and that a lot of crooks and bad people and criminals would talk in this way, and that might be true. That totally might be valid. But I don't think that Tarantino is attempting to achieve realism in many aspects of his movies. I think there's clearly like a hyper-stylized thing. So that kind of doesn't hold up. It's not like he's chasing realism and therefore doing the most realistic depiction. So, and on the other end of it, I think there's an aspect to it where, again, the essentialism within the narrative, like, those aspects of it are more often than not an essential component of the narrative, and yet a necessity of many of these characters. And that starts to tread into territory of like feeling like he just likes the sound of these words as dialogue. And he feels like they're an essential part of the dialogue. And whether that's because they're controversial, whether that's because they're jarring, whether that's because to him they're signifiers of bad people. Because I do think a lot of his politics have oftentimes been very on the right side of history, at least nominally. There's a disconnect where for him, whether they're signifiers, whether they're just things that feel right for his dialogue, they're things that carry a lot more weight than he gives them in the movies. And I think that's the core of what really throws me with it, is the cavalierness with which a white director and a white writer is writing those epithets for white characters to say. It doesn't have to happen. He's making the whole thing up. It's all invented. So he doesn't have to make those choices. And there are plenty of other ways he could signify those things that wouldn't have a triggering effect on non-white viewers. And yet he continues to sort of make those choices. And that's the part that the more that I watch these movies, the less I'm comfortable with it.
I have a very complicated view on this, just because I'm with you in that this is not necessary, and that a lot of the ways that he uses, racial epithets is not critical of the story. But at the same time, there are a lot of character aspects that aren't critical to the story that we kind of gloss over, whether it's, people being sexist or, misogynistic or terrible in other ways. And this is kind of the one that manifests itself most distinctly and clearly with one word. And I think when you were talking about how they're on this evil spectrum, like you were saying, and that you're not supposed to glean that they're good people and that this is just part of kind of that character aspect, I mean, I think that is part of it. His character in this movie is supposed to be a piece of shit who helps them find a dead body, who I think is married to a black woman in the movie, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Yep. Or at least through like a
the pseudo flash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sideways. But she is shown in the movie. Correct. Yeah. And the grander context to that withstanding, it's like, I think in that at least scene, it just adds of like, oh yeah, this dude's an ultra piece of shit who is, you know, along with them trying to help them out. Whether that decision is a good one, but I can understand someone writing that character.
Yeah, I kind of read that more as like a, all right, this kind of guards me against criticism because like then it's a choice to make this guy have a black wife and be saying this the whole time. Like that's, but like, I don't know. It's one of those things where like, he has this nuance to him where he can write really beautiful, nuanced things and these non sequitur type of conversations, and then kind of just hammers you over the head with one single word that throws you out of it, and it's jarring. And yeah, I didn't enjoy it, especially on this rewatch.
Yeah, I, you know, it's a tricky thing to like toe the line between. I remember, you know, when I was younger, like coming into my own as a person who sweared and, you know, having conversations with my mom about that and the sort of antiquated notion of like, okay, but like there are so many ways you could say a thing without swearing and being like, but no, that's the right word for it, you know? And like, so I understand the idea of like, okay, just because something isn't quote unquote necessary doesn't mean it's the right word, especially as a writer. Like I understand there's certain things that have a rhythm to them and have a, you know, and whatever. I get that. I really do. And I understand that like Tarantino is a writer's writer in that way and is one of the most brilliant dialogists that we've ever had. And that's not the most paramount thing. Like that can't be the be all end all when. And if it is for you as a white man, then you're fucking up. Because the, like, yes, maybe as a writer, the best rhythm and the thing that sounds the best and fits the best and most clearly defines that character for you is this thing that is going to have this really fucked up impact on people who watch your movie. You're a good enough writer. Pick another fucking word. Like, you can do it. It's possible. It is that. What Jimmy, right? Jimmy's the character. There are a bazillion ways you can signify Jimmy is a piece of shit, like a absolute bottom of the barrel garbage human that one, aren't actively triggering to people, and two, aren't actively triggering to people who aren't you. You know what I mean? Like, if he was doing something that was showing that he was a piece of shit that was somehow going after people of his own identity, his own experience, something like that, that wasn't like punching down sounds like it's, you know, a whole stratification of racism. That's not the point. But in terms of oppression politics, right? In terms of like that stuff that wasn't operating from this, like, there's not a word to go after white people. So I'm going to go with this other epithet. It just, you could get there. You could signify that he's a garbage piece of shit. His part doesn't even fucking matter. That movie doesn't fall apart if I think he's less of a piece of shit. You know what I mean? Like it
honestly,
just,
if
it
you think he's like kind of a nice guy who's
who's hiding a body,
like
he could hide a body, and I got
where,
it.
You know, he's just gotta hide a dead body.
That would be a fine movie. That wouldn't take away from the movie at all. And I feel like when, especially when you get again the like successful white creator arguing that their vision can't be realized unless it's unencroached upon by these restrictions that involve accounting for other people's experiences, that it feels lazy and it feels deeply sort of versed in that stratification of like of privilege, and it's really hard to get past. And that's not saying that like Pulp Fiction is an incredibly made movie. Pulp Fiction is an incredibly important movie and is worth watching. And my experience of watching it has changed every time. But at this point, having experienced it, having that sort of lexicon already there, it's hard not to just focus on the things I'm critical of. Because I'm not getting the like, oh my God, this is how this changed movies. This is how this was an important thing, right? So it's not an argument against Pulp Fiction being made or against Quentin Tarantino as a director. It's just a like, the more you sit with it, the harder it is to feel like those parts had to be there to get the other things. And that's the thing that I hope for from him as a director with how, you know, if he makes one or however many movies he makes from here, like I would love for him to have the faith in his like abilities to not need to use that, to not need to disregard other people's experiences of his movies in that way.
So I have a question of, if it wasn't him, and I think that is the biggest thing in this movie for me. It's like the director is the one who's acting in this role. And
like you're talking about that.
Like I said,
yeah,
like
I think
Eric Stoltz's character, Tim Roth. You don't need that from any of the, so like, even if it was Steve Buscemi as it was supposed to originally have been, it still would have kind of fucked with my experience there.
Right. If it was a non-white director who was writing it, it would still be really jarring to see it from that character. But the decision-making is there's a different equation happening. And with this, you have the white director who is also the white writer who's having either a white character or himself say the thing. And that's a different equation than if you had a non-white director who was doing it or a non-white actor. If you change one piece of that to a non-white character or a non-white actor or a non-white director, it's a different equation. Just because of the power dynamics with it, right? It's a very different thing to have a white man who's in control of the whole thing making the determination about what's going to be said versus a non-white person making that determination.
So some of the filmmaking was good. One of the shots that really stuck with me this time that I hadn't really thought about the last few times I'd seen it because it's been so long and I wasn't really as much of a cinephile as I am now. But the scene where Bruce Willis and John Travolta first meet in the club, where you get kind of this shot where it's kind of spinning around their interaction, and it's a very antagonistic.
I'm not your friend, pal. Yeah. I'm not your pal guy. I'm not your guy, buddy.
It's a really one that club is a really color palette. Shouts to the color palette in that club. What a great setting to have that meeting, and two, the choice to like kind of get all angles of their faces reacting to like. Why Bruce Willis being like, why was that guy just such an asshole to me for no reason? And then especially having seen it already, knowing what the end of that interaction turns out to be, is just such a fantastic choice. All right, cool. Anybody else?
We already hit on Samuel L. Jackson as Jules.
But say what I mean, again?
Holy shit. Like, that is... It's like watching, you know, Pacino right before Pacino flipped the switch and just became the parody of Pacino, right? It's the same thing of like...
So right in the airplane scene of Son of a Woman. Perfect.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like... It's before the first hoo-ah. It's really incredible to see that and to think like, oh... People didn't know this yet. Like, this wasn't a thing yet, yeah. You know? He's incredible in that. It's really interesting knowing that he wrote that for Fishburne. Like, that was initially a Fishburne role, which you can see and could totally work. But Samuel L. Jackson is so perfect in that role. And I think especially the diner scene, like the second diner scene.
Yeah.
With him is the real like just total showstopper. This will come back, but my experience of watching John Travolta was weird in this because I feel like the first time I watched this, I thought John Travolta was a really good actor. Like my conception of John Travolta as a person was that he was a good actor, and now my perception of John Travolta is not that. And so,
I mean, we did. Just so watch I had a different Face experience. Off. So you get
right exactly.
You get good Travolta.
So yeah, to be fair, I have recently experienced great, canonically great Travolta, but I don't know. It was a weird, like, I felt like I just, in that my lens there was kind of different because I had different expectations of him, if that makes sense.
In the words of Bowlet, coming up.
Okay, we might be on the same page.
I think cool. We are.
yes. Amazing. Yeah, any last takes from Pulp Fic?
No, I mean, I don't think we're going to really add much to the Pulp Fiction discourse at this point. It's been out for, you know, 20 years.
The preeminent takes on Pulp Fiction.
I think that market has been saturated enough that we can just say.
You know what would be super cool, though, is if we could do the Jules monologue, because I feel like that's something that's never been done before. Do we think that maybe someone could do the Jules monologue?
Yeah, for sure.
What do we think?
Yeah. Let's pad out this runtime a little bit.
All right.
Yeah, I just want to say Uma Thurman is so fucking good in this movie.
Oh, my God. She's so good.
Mm-hmm. Shout to Amherst Regional High School.
Wasn't it middle school?
Oh, yeah. Just go to Amherst Regional Middle School. Friday.
Amherst Regional Middle School. No, she did a year at the high school.
Oh, okay.
She did a year I had a library flipped. Book that she checked out once. That was cool.
Hell yeah.
Wow. Classic.
I'm famous.
Man, the god Uma, I miss her in movies. I want her in more movies. She's so fucking good in this. I wish her experience on Tarantino movies was better, like as an actress, but I love everything she's done.
She's
in every
coming
Tarantino
back.
Movie
she has a movie this year, I think, right?
Is she really?
I saw her in a trailer or something. Here, I'll look this up and make sure I'm not making it up. An
absolute all timer.
So good. And then I think that just leaves Fruitvale Station.
Fruitvale Station,
and that was our group pick, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was the ballot pick of the round. Which none of us had seen, I believe, right?
No. It was another one of those ones we missed that...
Yeah, right.
that had been on my watch list for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And was like, I'll get to it at some point. I'll get to it at some point. It's 90 minutes. I can
not,
get to that.
Not to interrupt the intro to a way more important movie, but she's in a 2020 PG film... called The War with Grandpa, starring Robert De Niro.
Yeah. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
That's on our next our next watch list, right?
So yeah, don't get...
That's on our next ones we missed for 10 years from now.
Yo, she's in Playing for Keeps. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was the she was Dennis Quaid's wife.
Oh, she was.
She's the one he didn't sleep with.
Oh, yeah.
But maybe he did. I still think before he went to pick up Dennis Quaid at jail.
Off camera. Yeah, right. Exactly. Quickie.
The ones we missed. Atlantics, Mulholland Drive, Pulp Fiction, Playing for Keeps, Fruitvale Station.
If you haven't seen Playing
One
for
Keeps... One of these things is not like the other.
If you haven't seen Playing for Keeps, you probably don't need to. But if you want to get a good group of people together and watch a Gerald Butler movie... where a lot of soccer moms try to fuck him. It's great.
Incredible. All right. On a slightly different
And now note. For something completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Fruitvale Station, 2013 film by Ryan Coogler featuring Michael B. Jordan, tells the story of the murder of Oscar Grant in 2009. Oscar Grant, young man who was murdered by transit police, the BART police in San Francisco, right?
Bay Area transit.
In Oakland, yeah, Bay Area. I mean this was like one of the most like emotionally devastating watches ever, up there forever, certainly of the last however long. It's like it's a brilliantly directed movie. It's a brilliantly acted movie. It's a brilliantly put together movie, and it's just really hard. It's just a really, really hard movie to watch. And you know, this is a podcast where we like shit on movies and make fun of things, and it's really hard to have a conversation about this that feels like, you know, compassionate towards what it's about and also like light enough to get into. So, you know, that as a preface, I am really interested in like what people thought of it.
Yeah. Because it is about a real life event. It's kind of like trying to critique a documentary about something. We've watched documentaries that are about things this important, and It's hard to be like, yeah, like some of the writing was a little clunky, and like that's absolutely true about this movie, mm-hmm. but it didn't affect how it affected me emotionally. I think it's really brilliantly done in terms of showing the initial stages of the actual video first, and giving you that gut punch right away. Which
I don't think it's a gut punch. More or less, it grounds you in reality throughout the whole movie. That's kind of what, it is a gut punch. And like,
I had never seen the video before.
I
always try to avoid watching those videos, but obviously, as like a piece of the film, like,
it's
effective.
For me, it was just a reminder of the real stakes that this movie, you know,
it's a very important structural choice to put that first and to really remind you that, like, you're watching a movie that is a fictionalized but not mm-hmm. fictional.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. Yeah. It happened. And to not lose sight of the fact that you're watching Michael B. Jordan, like, that's not the point.
Mm-hmm. I think that decision is absolutely brilliant in this movie.
Yeah, totally.
That if you just put it at the end and have it as a, you know, a clip on to the pre-credits kind of thing, which, you know, the cards that show up for a lot of those fictionalized nonfiction events, I think that doesn't carry quite the same weight that when the whole movie that you're watching, you know, this horrific fucking event happened and you have that image of it in your head the whole time while you're watching this day-to-day life of Oscar Grant go by.
And then while you're watching it, it's basically the story of him. I think he was 22. Basically the story of him, he lost his job. He's trying to get his job back. It's his mom's birthday. It's he's trying to raise a daughter. Just like totally emotionally grips you from every angle. Like understanding that this is just a human being. Like this, it's such a good portrait of a human being. Like trying to get you every aspect of that over a really short period of time, and it succeeds in that. And I think obviously you get three pretty tremendous acting performances from Michael B. Jordan, Melanie Diaz, and Octavia Spencer. And that can only help. And classic.
Sorry, you left Chad Michael Murray off that list, and I feel like personally offended for.
He would be a Bob Odenkirk if it wasn't.
Coming up! Yeah. Coming up!
And Marjorie Crump Shears, who plays Grandma Bonnie. How dare you leave her off?
Yeah, it's a movie that I'm probably going to put on the back burner for a while and not watch it, but if I'm in the mood for just, like, absolutely...
devastation,
which, I mean, it's a mood that strikes sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, trust me. Yeah. I know. So...
yeah, it's just really good. Classic... like 4-star movie that I didn't press the like button on.
Yeah, I agree with that. My only critique is that, like you said, Chris, the writing is a little clunky at times. It definitely feels like it just feels like a wow, this dude had the most last day ever of last day evers, where like every single conversation he had is super salient to his life story. And just kind of feels written up for the moment, rather than letting some really authentic conversations that you may be able to glean some sort of bigger meaning off of, happen. It just kind of, you know, the one that sticks out to me is when he's waiting, and he lets his girlfriend use the bathroom and, you know, another guy comes up. That one felt like a little bit heavy handed, you know, it was like, man, what are you waiting for? Why haven't you proposed to your girlfriend yet? You know? That one just, it felt like it was, it just could have been rewritten in a way that wasn't.
Here's my card if you ever need anything, like that kind of stuff.
Because so much of the rest of the movie was so really delicately well written that scene just kind of stuck out as like a real, you know, put your hammer on the scale kind of thing.
Yeah, I totally agree with that scene. I don't know that I agree across the board, but that was one that was very glaring, and there were definitely moments of that, and let me point out how heartbreaking, like the looking forwards when you know there's not a forwards to look towards, you know, ness of it. I think that the thing for me that was the most impactful on the Coogler front, I think what this sort of signified as like a path forwards was like his ability to, you know, tying it back to how we were talking about Atlantics, right? The nuance with which he can deal with a story that, you know, when we deal with issues of sort of like profound tragedy that involve people that we don't know, right? Like there's no reason any of us would know Oscar Grant other than him being murdered by a BART officer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the very human tendency is to go to one end of the extreme or the other, to like deify that person somehow.
Yep.
And make them a martyr in the sense of not the tragedy of what happened to them, but like make them and their entire existence into this sort of martyrdom, or to go to the other end, which, you know, person to person, right? But I think one of the tendencies societally is to vilify a person and to say, like, come up with the reasons that they deserved it, the things that were bad about them, the things that were evil about them, the things that they did that were asking for it, right? That's the go-to. What were they wearing? What were they doing? What, you know,
it's looking for the justification for whatever reason. Yeah. It's like, oh, 8 years ago he did
this. He was in jail. Yeah. He was fighting. He was
and doing it's like, yeah, well, that, and that stuff is brilliantly in the movie to
exactly right, and that is what makes this movie, I think, such an excellent portrayal of this. Again, qualitative shit with this movie is a very weird thing to deal with, right?
Yeah,
that's not the fucking point.
I mean, so
but
go ahead, sorry.
But one of the things that I think Coogler does with such nuance and with such sort of grace in the construction of the movie is, the dude lost his job, and he didn't lose his job because they come up with some whole story about how he's a tragic figure. He lost his job because he was late all the time. Like, he didn't fucking show up for his job, right? You see the setup for the fight that happens and how that
as
construction happens. And as a flashback, and you see what precipitates it, right? And it's the interactions between those people. Like, you get the foundation for things, and it treats him as a human. It treats him as a person who's fucked up and done some fucked up things, who is really wonderful and is an incredible father, but also fucks up as a father, but is a terrible parent in certain ways, and then is a wonderful parent and a wonderful partner and a wonderful, like, you get the humanity of him as a person, and then it gets all fucking taken away from you. And you lose... You experience the loss of an actual human rather than the loss of an idea or the loss of a character playing a certain role. Like, they establish him as a multifaceted human before they take him away from you. And it feels like so fucking bastardized and weird to say take away from you, because that's not the fucking point. But as the filmmaker, it is the point to make you feel like you're losing a person who you've developed an attachment to, as a way to help you understand why it is so fucking heinous that this shit happens, and this shit happens to actual people in the experience. The only goal of a movie like this has to be to create some type of empathy, and the way to create that empathy is to make you feel loss in some semblance of a way that the people who actually experience it feel lost. And this movie does that in such an effective way. And that's, it's absolutely devastating to experience. And it's, I don't know when I'll watch this movie again, if I will. But it deals with it the way that it needs to. And it deals with it like in such a graceful and such an effective way. And it's on so many counts, on the performances, on the direction, on the writing, even if at moments the writing doesn't, you know, feels more fabricated. I think on the whole, it's one of the most effective portrayals of that type of thing based on a real event, right? Obviously, if it's not a real event, you can have more liberties with it. But I was pretty blown away by that. And I'm still, you know, kind of figuring out how to think about it as a movie beyond that.
I think the whole sequence, once he gets back on the train to the end of the movie, is just unbelievable. You know, that is when it, like, it turns into,
I mean, you know, as soon as he gets,
it's Dredd. Yeah.
As soon as he gets on the train to go out, I think, like, from that point on, you're kind of thinking, like, all right.
Well, it's from when his mom says you should take a train.
Yeah. I guess that's just, like, the whole movie, you know what's going to happen, but you're kind of, you're in this bliss of, like, okay, this is all kind of, like, well, we're not living that reality right now. We're kind of living in his life. And then once, as soon as you are reminded of what happens, it really kicks in, and it's fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Hard pivot.
Like, we gotta. I don't think we can possibly pivot softly off that.
Well, I mean, aside from saying the officer, what was it, Messerell, something like that. Yeah. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Not important to get that dude's name right.
Ended up serving 11 months. Yeah. Like, that was, you know, got charged with involuntary manslaughter for shooting a dude in the back.
I believe the defense was that he thought it was a taser.
Thought it was his taser. Yeah.
Which also in the film, it did a great job of using tasers to kind of lay that foundation for that idea.
And yep. Piece of shit should have been in jail longer. Whole other conversation about incarceration and, like, the prison industrial complex and, like, whether, you know, but very, you know, 2009 key example of, like, justice not being done, and and it's not any fucking different. So yeah, with that hard pivot, the categories.
Jesus.
So, for obvious reasons, in some cases, Fruitvale might come up, but in some categories, Fruitvale will not come up in these categories because it feels, you know, of the group of movies that feels sort of wildly inappropriate to include in certain ways. So, that's all it is. Every week on Ballot, we'll be doing sort of some categories, some awards that we give out, which we've given out in the past, but we've sort of consolidated them as a structural thing. One of which we've already hit, which is the designated Hitler. The other ones are the Bob Odenkirk, which is for an actor who appears sort of late in a movie and has a key role, or late in a movie and is surprising, or named after Bob Odenkirk's appearance in Little Women as definitely just Bob Odenkirk, and, but also the dad.
And Dolomite Is My Name in the same year.
Also, in the same year. The Lakeith Stanfield, which is for dude who shows up in lots of movies. The Dom Cobb Award for what the fuck kind of name is Dom Cobb? The Rebecca Pigeon Award for what the fuck is that accent? The James Woods Award for absolute piece of shit, either actor or person. Character. Designated Hitler we covered, and then the F. Gary Gray Awards, which we'll get into when we get there, but the short version is it's fuck, marry, kill, more or less. So let's start off with the Bob Odenkirk. What do we have for Bob Odenkirk Award winners?
Okay, so the, like, obvious one was Chad Michael Murray. That, like, very insensitive to be putting that there. So I'm going to doctor the category a little bit and just say the person that I was most surprised to see was Billy Ray Cyrus.
That's mine.
What the fuck, Billy Ray Cyrus is in this movie. That's my Odenkirk for this round.
That's a good choice. I had
again, in the spirit of like character who becomes sort of a central figure despite not having been in the whole thing. Having already seen Pulp Fiction, wasn't the same reaction this time, but Harvey Keitel just like showing up at the end of that movie and like being a sort of key linchpin is probably.
I think if I hadn't seen him in the credits, that probably would have given me that that experience, because I didn't remember he was in the movie until I saw him in the credits.
I was way more shocked by Billy Ray Cyrus showing up. Billy Ray Cyrus!
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
I mean, Keitel shows up in movies.
Yeah,
Billy Ray Cyrus.
Let's get to it.
So Lakeith, I have Harvey Keitel.
Yeah, I have Harvey Keitel.
he's in Pulp Fiction. He's in Clockers, and he appears very briefly, apparently in like one shot in Apocalypse Now, because he was originally cast in the role that Martin Sheen ended up playing.
He's also in National Treasure, which is a honorary ballot movie.
Great choice.
It's Harvey Keitel.
I copped out. I went with Michael B. Jordan because he's been in a couple between that and Creed. But I think Harvey Keitel is the choice.
Yeah.
The Dom Cobb Award. I'm interested
or
in what people
Harge
have for the
Aired
Dom
Award,
aka Harge.
Or the Harge Aired Award. Yeah.
I went with Vincent Vega.
He was close for me.
Good choice.
That is the kind of name that you write when you think you're really cool at writing character names, and it just doesn't work.
I went with from the same film, Butch Coolidge.
Yeah. Butch Coolidge! yeah, baby!
Be Bruce Willis.
I had Butch
character.
Coolidge, too. Yeah, Butch Coolidge, definitely a fake name.
It was either that or The Cowboy, so... Yeah, who needs that? I actually don't have a Rebecca Pigeon.
Well, I'm suspicious that Chris and I have the same Rebecca Pigeon.
I believe we both have Travolta as Vincent Vega.
That would be Vincent Vega. What the fuck was that accent,
dude? I think
dude?
It was supposed to be Tennessee.
I think it was supposed to be Travolta in like other Travolta movies.
Yeah, I
that shit is.
I was going to text you guys both like. Red alert accent watch for Travolta, but I didn't want to spoil this.
When he's doing the Royale with cheese
it's
bit.
Heavy.
Royale with cheese.
It's like, I don't know that I've heard someone put it on like that. Like, holy shit. It's bad. There's a slight Justin Theroux as Adam Kesher. Like there's some shit going on there, but
that's not.
But we'll mostly let it slide.
It's stylized.
But if both of you had gotten Vincent Vega, I might have pivoted to Adam Kesher. But it's Vincent Vega.
Yeah.
Also, shouts to Vincent Vega. So Vincent Vega is the canonical brother of Mr. Pink, right? In Reservoir Dogs.
Is that
the ear cutter dude.
Madsen, Michael Madsen. No, what's
Michael
is
Madsen.
Is that his name? All right.
Yep. And there was for a long time rumored like a Vega Brothers movie that was supposed to happen that obviously we're kind of past.
So I think this is one of the things that I think I'm probably going to disagree most with Nate on, but expanded universe stuff, I could not care less about.
I think I definitely don't care about the Vega expanded universe.
Yeah, it's like they show this poster that's in both Vincent Vega's bedroom and Michael Madsen's bedroom. It's like I don't give a fucking shit. Who cares?
You're talking about it like it's some fucking Reddit nerds. It's a Tarantino thing. Like Tarantino has talked about how he named both these characters Vega, and he wanted to make a movie that was
on,
the Vega
on a micro scale. Yes, Quentin Tarantino is a super
a fucking nerd. Quentin Tarantino nerd
on a grander scale. I don't give a fucking shit about what movies intersect with what movies. That is just stuff I could not care less about. It's like...
It's your loss for not growing up with comics.
No. Yeah. I just had to have my Bounty Hunter Star Wars books. That was my only respite.
Dengar! Dengar!
Zuckus and Forlaw!
Well, actually, Boba Fett survived the Sarlacc Pit and then went on to team up with Dengar and Forlom and Zuckus.
And
so IG-88. They went on.
So Dengar hopped on his Houndstooth. And
yeah.
Jesus.
Well, is actually, the Houndstooth was Bosk's ship, and so...
Was it Slave One was Dengar's?
Actually, Slave One was Boba Fett's ship, and so...
Jesus Christ.
All right. The James... Speaking of pieces of shit, the James Woods Award.
All right, so accepting, like, actual real-life murderers...
Let's move away. So this is... We have now gotten into the... We are not talking about Fruitvale Station because it feels very cavalier to talk about that in, a joking, comical way. So we're dealing with, movies other than Fruitvale Station because, obviously, the biggest pieces of shit were all the BART fucking transit fuckers.
So I'm interested to hear what you guys have because I have a two-horse race here. I settled on Peter Green's character from Pulp Fiction, the racist rapist.
Yep, Maynard.
Which one was that?
Maynard. I mean, he's the security guard who,
gets his
nuts shut off. Zed. He has the Z keychain.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think there's
good talk.
Okay, no. So my other one was the construction company owner from Atlantics who fucks a bunch of people out of money and ends up responsible for the deaths of many of his workers because he didn't pay them for 3 to 4 months.
It's definitely in the running.
Yeah, I mean Diane Selwyn could be one.
Yep.
But no, I think it's the
ostensibly
racist,
like Jimmy as Tarantino as Jimmy, I think was a fair game just based on that monologue. Yep. But like, yeah, no, I think Zed's got it locked up.
Yeah. Wait, who is Maynard then? It's Maynard and Zed are the
Maynard is the dude who runs the shop.
Oh, gotcha.
The guy who
I think he just like calls up his buddy and is like, all right, we can come.
Yeah.
Don't finish that sentence. Ridiculous shit
don't,
down here.
Don't finish that sentence. Don't clip that.
Yeah. All right. So F. Gary Gray. Now, F. Gary Gray, or in certain cases, F. Gary Gray, law-abiding citizen, depending on the round and whether it's appropriate to include all four movies.
I'd be really excited to see if next round we have a law-abiding citizen.
Next round is a very solid F. Gary Gray law-abiding citizen round.
I have a bad feeling it might be mine.
I don't think you're wrong. So F. Gary Gray is our take on Fuck, Marry, Kill, named after the esteemed named after F. Gary Gray, or in certain cases, F. Gary Gray, Law Abiding Citizen, a movie that for some reason I heard lots of people talk about as good, turns out not. So this is where we categorize individually the collection of movies based on effing, garying, or graying, or law-abiding citizening. So let's go around the horn. Let's start with Zach. What was your F. Gary Gray? Because, again, we're sticking to F. Gary Gray for this one.
Are we excluding Fruitvale from this?
Yes.
Or, okay.
We are excluding Fruitvale because it feels wildly inappropriate to in any way include Fruitvale in this type of game.
Oh, God. I don't want to do this. Chris, go first.
All right. So for F, I have Atlantics. I feel like it, given all of the things that it gives you in one package, great.
All right, I don't feel so bad.
Oh, man.
Jesus Christ.
It just gives you so much. All right, Gary. I'm garying Mulholland Drive. I think that's one I'm going to be revisiting many, many, many times. Yeah. And I'm graying Pulp Fiction. I feel like that's one, like, if I never saw it again in my entire life, it wouldn't hurt me in any way.
Yep. Exact same list for me.
Yeah. I think for me, the only thing I hate to do this. I guess I am effing Pulp Fiction because I think the highs of that movie are so incredibly great that you can if I want to go back and rewatch a scene or two from a movie, it's going to be Pulp Fiction. It like graying Atlantics is not fair because I think it's an absolutely incredible movie.
This is why this is a great category, because it forces you into horrible decisions.
Yeah. I think because that movie does not have as standout scenes, it kind of falls a little bit in this. But I would F Pulp Fiction, Gary Mulholland Drive, and Gray Atlantics.
Yeah,
a sentence that no one should ever say.
Thank you, Ivy, for giving us two of the greatest things of this podcast.
F. Gary Gray and the Designated Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I totally get that, Zach, and I also think that the relationship with Pulp Fiction is also like, again, you know, when I saw Pulp Fiction, like my first experience of seeing Pulp Fiction was like, holy fucking shit. And then having seen it more now, I can be more critical of it. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder about, like, you know, in terms of how many times you've seen it, how much it's integrated into what you do. Like, it's easier to possibly sort of like shift it to the side and be like, fuck that shit. Or conversely, it's easier to sort of be like, well, the high points are the best points. So, you know,
if I'm going to F something, I want to go out on that highest high.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm just going to be dancing the jitterbug out on that 1950s.
The twists.
I will. If I could F a single scene, the dance sequence, just that twist sequence is, I mean, There is no accent watch for Travolta when he is silently twisting. Just what a fucking champ.
But that scene continued into the scene where they're going back to her place and
it's
like walking
so
through
good.
The door.
Yeah.
This is my thing. And again, in the most hashtag not a director way, like, give me the fucking short film that's just the like the Vincent Vega run of like, if you did the nonlinear version of that, I'm in. That shit is amazing. You could still cut the Tarantino, you know, having his fucking N-word fest, but man, like that whole sequence, like the dance sequence into the going home sequence is unbelievable shit.
Yeah.
No. Hot takes from Ballot.
Yeah. Great round. Yeah,
good round.
I loved all of the suggestions that we
each
had, and it was great way to kick off a new chapter where we only watch four movies per episode. So
in this most challenging year, we thought we might turn over a new leaf.
That feels as good a segue as any to our upcoming round, which. Maybe not love all the suggestions, but all the suggestions. We've got four movies for this next round. The topic for this round is three-star movies that we love like five-star movies. So,
which apparently everybody interpreted as, I like this movie when I was 7 years old. But now I look really at the Rotten Tomatoes exercise. Rating, and turns out
Boy, was I wrong.
There was a really interesting just exercise of trying to figure out like what fits this of like what do you have a nostalgic love for that is not actually as good as you thought it was versus what do you have a nostalgic love for that is validated by critics and things like that. You know, there's a lot of movies that kind of lived maybe more in the 4-star rating that you love more than you should. So to get a 3-star rating that you love more than a 3-star rating is a tricky thing. But we landed with four movies, including one movie from our friend Dave Katwiwa, who is going to be joining us on this upcoming episode. So rather than having a ballot pit, we have a one pick from each of us. The movies that we chose are The Mask of Zorro. Dear God.
So Nate, you picked The Mask of Zorro.
Yeah, I picked The Mask of Zorro, a movie that somehow has a runtime of 2 hours and 16 minutes. We've got Starship Troopers, which was picked by Dave. We We've got Blue Streak, which was picked by Chris, which, spoiler alert, three of us already watched together inadvertently.
No, on purpose. Like, we didn't.
I mean, on purpose, but once we had all started it.
That wasn't as random as both you and me, Nate, watching A Prophet at approximately the same time.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that's one of 25 movies we watched for that round.
And finally, we have, in the words of Zachary Phillips, a seminal American film, GoldenEye.
About British intelligence.
James Bond. James Bond, famously American.
I will say, I'm really excited to watch all of these because, with the exception of the one we just watched, which until a couple of days ago also fell into this category, I haven't seen any of these movies since I was like 15 at the oldest.
Yeah. I mean, the years of release for this are 1995, 1998, 1999, and 1997. Like,
we really boxed it in there.
We nailed it.
I'm really excited to exclusively be on the podcast going, Boris! Yes. And yes, I am invincible!
Chris, can you do your best Xenia Onatopp accent for us?
Zach, he needs to be in the same place so he can. 12.
It's a shitty Russian accent. You know what it sounds like.
You need a partner so you can choke them out with your leg lock.
Yeah. Also, I think we're going to devote a lot of time in this next episode to Anthony Hopkins that Nate found.
Hey, that was me.
Oh, sorry, Chris found.
Yeah, I did not find. However, I did have that haircut. So
I saw his name in the movie. One, I saw he was in the movie that I didn't remember. Two, I saw his name is Don Diego, and I had to know what he looked like in this movie.
Don Diego de la Verga.
And spoiler alert, it's hot!
Flowing silver locks.
Oh, man. What a... I'm jarred by hot Hopkins. It really... It's not what I was ever expecting.
Anthony,
so anyways,
Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins.
Anyways, thanks for listening to episode whatever the fuck of Ballot, Gabe.
We'll call it one. Episode one.
We'll call it one.
No, we stop. One. Stop naming episodes of this fucking podcast. It's a podcast.
No. We can do this. Them.
I need something to season save three. It. I need a folder to save all these files.
Just put a date. Three. Put a date. Jesus Christ!
But you can't use. Thanks slashes. For listening to
season
to
three, episode one.
I'm hanging up.
Slashes are my preferred way to denote a date, but unfortunately they refer to file locations, so you can't use slashes. It's a whole thing. I would rather episode
Nerd.
Number.
All right. Thanks for listening to Ballot. Episode you. One, season three. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
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 God damn it, Chris.
Oh, hold on. Good timing. I might just give Nelson back right now. Lexi just walked in the door. I'll be right back.
I'll miss you.
Here's your dog.
Ha 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 ha!